In the previous episode, we looked at how Palestinians lived in the 1800s, and we also explored the interests of European colonialists in this region of the world. This included both Christian and Jewish interest, despite Palestine being under rule by the Ottomans at the time. In that respect, we witnessed the birth of Jewish Zionism and a push to indoctrinate as many Jews as possible into believing in this ideology. In addition, we saw how Palestine began to fit into the political interests of Western Europe. So, as the 1900s began, how did life for Palestinians change in Palestine? How did the region change as the First World War had ravaged the region? And what further impact did Europe, the Europeans, and therefore the Zionists have on Palestine? So hello again, and welcome to episode 2 of Palestine, From Past to Present, where we will be looking at the history of Palestine through the ages. As the 1800s ended and we had begun to enter the 1900s, or the 20th century if you will, it was now the last 9 years, until 1909 that is, before the Ottoman Sultan Abdulhamid II's rule over the Ottoman Empire and therefore Palestine had ended. Some of the things Sultan Abdulhamid II did included railway expansion, conscription and taxation. He encouraged Ottoman citizenship and always feared the idea of nationalism among the region that he ruled, which included Palestine. Numerous Ottoman leaders have tried to come to terms with this and solidify the occupation of the Levant, which included regions, or rather countries that we know of today, such as Lebanon, Syria and Palestine itself, just like in the 1870s again. This tension between state and civilians was once again an example of how the Arabs wanted independence from the Ottomans, seeing things in their own Arab perspectives. However, the Sultan did not agree with the Tanzimat reforms of 1839 that we covered last time. Instead, he got rid of or expelled the reformers because he did not feel that that was the right direction to go into to bring all people of the Ottoman Empire together, given his rapidly declining influence and pressure from Europe. Instead, he opted for pan-Islamism, where using Islam was the plan to bring most people in the empire together, especially the Arabs, whose support he desperately needed. He was losing loyalty from and influence on Greece, Armenia, and Bulgaria anyway. His plan failed in encouraging Ottoman nationalism, as Arabs and other groups continued in their nationalism, and instead, the Sultan opted for a full police state where he targeted anyone who threatened his regime. Regardless of the pressure from the Ottoman state, Palestine's integration into the European and world economy continued, with the lives of peasantry changing completely as there became a loss of the system of self-sufficiency and more workers hired agriculturally, with the most work appearing just outside of cities for this labour force. Again, like in the past, politicisation of the Palestinian elite and notables was attempted to allow them to have a greater say in local politics, be more legitimate in the eyes of Palestinians, and this was a benefit for the Sultan to make the Ottoman ruler overall look better. Palestinians soon began to dislike the European newcomers, seeing them not as immigrants, but as usurpers, as they claimed land in the valleys regardless of whether they were Christian or Jewish. Palestinians protested and sent petitions to the government for this rise in European land claims to be dealt with. The nobility and society learned about this Zionism through Egyptian, Lebanese and Ottoman-based media at first, but the reality of the situation became very apparent as time went on, witnessing colonisation in real time. Notables who owned land and housing refused to sell it, and even requested the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem issue rulings against them. Small, local, Palestinian municipalities were voted in too, and they passed resolutions to stop the sale of housing and land to Jewish Europeans. It is unlikely that the Palestinians understood, regardless of whether they were Muslim, Christian or Jewish, what danger they faced amidst this acquisition of land and colonisation by mainly Jewish Europeans. Theodor Herzl now sought to increase the speed and likelihood of his colonisation becoming successful, and he started looking for a world superpower to support his ideology. The biggest superpower at the time was likely the United Kingdom, who was already implicit and an exporter of colonialism far and wide, from Australia and New Zealand to India, the USA and Canada. This was an obvious choice, as Britain had experience and ideological similarity, and with clear interests in the Middle Eastern region, which made it even more likely that they would support such a project. After all, Britain had already occupied Egypt in 1882, the Ottoman Empire was getting weaker and a collapse was possible, and Britain was always thinking of how to improve its trade routes, such as the one to India, also to protect the Suez Canal further. After all, Herzl wrote in his book Judenstadt that a Zionist state would, and I quote, form a part of a wall of defence for Europe in Asia, an outpost of civilization against barbarism, end of quote. Again, mimicking the language and justification for colonization of numerous places, such as North America, where the Native American population was exterminated and the few left subjugated for the sake of a white European settler colony. So already, with or without Zionists, expansionists in Britain were looking at Palestine as their next victim of occupation. But this is a reason why anyone who supported the British in their expansion or helped them achieve their aims would be welcomed. It was also worth noting that Britain had a number of evangelist Christians in position of power, government, and parliament. In which case, Zionists appealing to Britain to support their cause for the colonization of Palestine was a match that benefited both parties. We started to see pro-Zionists influence British policy and politics on the Middle East by appealing to the colonialists with a new colonial dream and indoctrination of the evangelical believers who, as mentioned, thought Jews, in inverted commas, returning to the Holy Land would precipitate the return of Jesus Christ himself. Herzl even asked the British if they could turn the Egyptian city that is not far from Gaza, in the northern Sinai region, El Arish, into a Zionist paradise, to which the British shut down the idea immediately. We discussed terra nullius earlier in the previous episode, and of the racist myths Europeans would sometimes spread to justify and legitimise colonisation. Palestine was no different in its treatment by Europeans, and despite there being a population, as we have covered in the numbers earlier, Zionists still used racist rhetoric to try to appeal to their fellow Europeans, whether they were Zionist or not. The first Zionist Congress, for example, did not mention the indigenous population of Palestine, and not much attention was paid to them at all. It went in the opposite direction even, as racist quotes and claims of Palestine being a, and I quote, land without a people for a people without a land, end of quote, were popularised by Zionist British writer Israel Zangwill, though first thought of by the 7th Earl of Shaftesbury. Christian and British Zionism has a long history, as evangelical figures like the 7th Earl of Shaftesbury himself also believed in the final days and for Jesus to come back. But this was all the way back in the 1830s, where he attempted to make people believe that this is what Jewish people wanted, to move to Palestine, though this was just a way for him to push his potentially very literal and extreme biblical beliefs. Followers of this particular Earl, just like the British Member of Parliament F. Lawrence Oliphant, considered a plan in the 1880s for this movement of European Jews to Palestine, and moving Palestinians into reservations, just like in North America. Christian Zionism predated Jewish Zionism anyway, with groups of Protestant Christians from the 17th century believing in attempting to fulfil biblical prophecy, and pushing for the return of Jesus Christ, and to do so they needed to push Jews into Palestine. These are people who believed in religious books being historical fact rather than articles of faith or belief. Now back to the quote, which neither Zangwill nor the territorial Zionist Chaim Weizmann used literally. As they were aware of the population present in Palestine, however, they used it more as to mean there is no people there worth considering above their European and Jewish supremacy. Zangwill even visited in 1897, telling Zionists in Manchester, Britain, that, and I quote, Palestine proper already has its inhabitants. The Pashalik of Jerusalem is already twice as thickly populated as the United States, having 52 souls to the square mile, and not 25% of them Jews, end of quote. Racism was evident, even when Weizmann sent letters to other Zionists, like the one to German Zionist Arthur Rupin, where he wrote about the Palestinians, and I quote, the British told us, that there are some 100,000 Negroes, and for those there is no value, end of quote. So for the British Christian Zionists, and for the wider European population of Jewish Zionists, to find each other at a time where Zionism needed an imperial power to support them, and for the British who needed a reason and for someone to protect their interests, was key. In addition to this, it also played with Christian, Zionist, or evangelical beliefs of the return of Jesus. But also, one more thing. Christian Zionism was not driven by philanthropy or kind-heartedness, nor just with their religious wishes of Jesus to come back, but also their Judeophobia, and their fear of what they believed to be a Zionist Jewish power. And of course, fear of immigration of Jews to Britain. This Judeophobia and attempt at utilising Jewish Zionism for British interests is shown by policies, such as the 1905 Aliens Act, enacted in Britain during Prime Minister Balfour's tenure. This act prevented immigration of Eastern European Jews to Britain, instead encouraging them to go to Palestine. Most went to the United States again, though some did go to Palestine or other European countries. This is certainly one of the lesser known actions in Balfour's era. The other one being the Balfour Declaration, which is the main one he is remembered for, though he did that one not as Prime Minister, but as Foreign Minister under David Lloyd George's Prime Ministership. Other than Arthur Balfour and David Lloyd George, other notable leaders of Britain associated with Zionism included Benjamin Disraeli, who was involved in occupying the Suez Canal and had a theory of Christian Protestantism being a perfected Judaism. And of course, the famous Winston Churchill, who was always very much a pro-Zionist and pro-British Empire. It was Palestinian philosopher Edward Said who said Europe was the main battleground for Zionist colonisation of Palestine, rather than Palestine itself, at least until 1948. By keeping the arena in Europe rather than the Middle East, Palestinians were stopped from representing themselves, or were made to look as if they were not capable of doing so. Thus making colonisation of Palestine via Zionism more attractive for Western Europe. Zionism did not just deny existence of Arabic-speaking Palestinians, but contradicting themselves, proceeded to show Europe that Palestinians can be, and I quote, managed, end of quote. The hostility towards Arabs, Islam, and the Middle East in general in Western Europe was something in common with Zionists, as well as their shared languages, which was always helpful too. Palestine was not the only location that the Zionists considered for establishment of their state. In fact, as Herzl was approaching the end of his life, he began to get desperate to establish something, and he opted for a Jewish state in Uganda instead. The territorial Zionists had ruined this plan of his. And other places were also considered, which included Argentina, that we've mentioned before, as well as Cyprus and the Sinai Peninsula. Nonetheless, Palestinian representatives of the Ottoman Parliament tried to prevent more European Jews in their expansion attempts and movement into Palestine. The new settlers, however, did not stop coming, settling the foundation for their future Zionist communities with the establishment of only 12 settlements. Key figures for these establishments included Russian Menachem Osishkin, who brought in professional organisations to assist in making these settlements permanent. And so, even though these settlements were not large in number, they were indeed steadily rising. Following the death of Herzl, other Zionists filled in the gaps, such as German Zionist Arthur Rupin, who we just mentioned in the letter from Weizmann. He took over, leading the German Zionists in their colonisation effort. Now, there is a word in Hebrew called Aliyah, which translates to ascent. And it is a central component of Zionism, as all people who are thought of as being Jewish should therefore move to Palestine, and this was very much encouraged. The first ascent, or rather, wave of immigration was approximately 1882 to 1903, but as we have discussed, very few people wanted to leave their homeland and throw away their history, to go to a foreign land. The second wave was 1904 to 1914, overseen by Rupin, by indoctrinating people to believe that they were in fact the original people from Palestine, and that they were kicked out of it, and that they are deserving of an, inverted commas, return. The second wave, of course, contained more people than the first, as the Ottoman Empire began to weaken further and further. In this period, the idea of kibbutz was assembled, which are collective settlements of these European expansionists. Thus, colonialism continued with or without Herzl, albeit slowly. The numbers, as I mentioned, were indeed rising. Even now, you will see people from the Bronx, or from the UK, or from anywhere in the world who are Jewish writing on social media that they have recently completed their Aliyah, or immigration, to Palestine. Many people even congratulate each other on this immigration. A system of colonization which seems to have been ingrained into people as being an article of faith and a requirement that makes people feel proud and leads to encouragement from others and to each other for those who either want to or have already played their part in the dispossession, colonization, and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians from Palestine. Amid these rising figures of European Jews, it is worth mentioning the Palestinian Jews, or, in other words, those indigenous to Palestine, like its Muslim and Christian populations. The Palestinian Jews were very religious and did not accept the European colonialists who came to build their ghettos in Palestine in the name of secular Judaism, when realistically all it was European expansion, colonization, and takeover of Palestine. Zionists contested everything with the Orthodox Palestinians, from slaughtering methods, burial rites, and even religious debates which they disagreed in, and more, as Europeans competed against the natives for domination of life in Palestine, and to try and preserve their European lifestyles. That is why, even though Al-Quds is seen as an important city, so Jerusalem is seen as an important city in Judaism, the Jews of Palestine did not allow the Zionists to settle there very easily. That is where more money was needed from Baron de Rothschild again, for the Zionists to use to establish a small community not far from Jerusalem in Palestine, to which they chose the suburbs of the Palestinian city of Jaffa. This community would eventually become what is known as Tel Aviv today, but would ultimately mean the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian population of the port city Jaffa, and then the absorbing of Jaffa into Tel Aviv, despite Jaffa being an ancient city that was thousands of years old. Zionists also got funding from an organization called the Jewish National Fund, or JNF for short, which is a name you should remember as we go on, as it is the second time I have mentioned them now, because they will be responsible for many atrocities that we have talked about. We'll talk about, and what's also shocking is the status they have as organisations in many modern Western countries, but that's for a later date. But just remember the name for the time being. Zionists now had an area exclusively for their ideology, and intentionally separate from the Palestinians, though still within Palestine, where most of the new inhabitants were Russians who were trying to dodge military service in the Russian army. Zionists preferred to stay within their own colonies, choosing not to mix with the indigenous Palestinians. There was even a ban on hiring Palestinian workers, despite the land itself being Palestinian. The Zionists, however, needed manpower in order to build their colonies and what was inside them, so instead, they hired Jews from Yemen, who would work for little pay in these settlements, and were then disposed of into slums beside the European Jewish colonies. Racism on so many levels, Palestinians, then to the Yemenis, regardless of their faith. There were still fewer than 50,000 new Zionists in Palestine. Whilst living in their isolated communities, they began to deal with the issue of politics, British support, the indigenous Palestinians who already lived there, unemployment, further colonisation, and immigration plans, currency, taxes, and more, especially as the Ottoman Empire looked as if it was approaching its downfall. Despite all of this and their attempts at hostility against those that already lived there, Zionists were still small in number compared to the Palestinians that had lived there for centuries and even millennia, when taking into account their ancestors. It is not until after World War I that life would change significantly for Palestinians, as we shall explore. In 1908, a group of officers and students called the Young Turks organised a coup against the Ottoman Abdul Hamid. They forced restoration of the constitution and reopening of parliament, and with further pressure on the Ottoman Sultan from his land losses in the Balkans, the Young Turks eventually successfully toppled him in 1909, thereby taking control. The Young Turks strictly outlawed any non-Turk-oriented autonomy, which included any autonomy the Arabs had established. People began to hope for a united Arab position, with many meetings in secret to discuss such views and movements. These groups included Palestinians, but the Turks responded to these movements with Turkification and secularism, which was separating religion from state. Of course, Palestinians were not interested in Turkification since they were not Turkish, and over time, Palestinian nationalism and as a whole, Arab nationalism increased further. This encouraged people to meet even more in secret and to join national associations, usually in Syria. Damascus was an intellectual centre for many of the region's Muslims and Christians who stood united, looking towards the future with hope in the face of what they now believed to be the final years of Ottoman control. The coup in 1909 would later be described as not simply the decline of Ottoman rule in Palestine, but the liberty of Palestine and the end of an empire in Palestine. So said Jamal al-Husseini, who held many important positions in Palestine, later in the 1920s and 30s, such as chairman of the Palestine Arab Congress or leader of the Palestine Arab Party in 1935. This change in government affected all denominations of Palestinians, though they all adapted reasonably quickly, with the Christians and Muslims having a stronger sense of nationalism to being a united Arab civilization, different to that of Ottoman rule. Education was more secular, controlled by the Ottomans, who at first allowed Arabic to try and win over the Palestinians, but eventually enforcing Turkish when they became aware that nationalism was continuing to rise in the face of this decision. However, all of this was short-lived as soon the people of Palestine would start to suffer amid the First World War, with the schooling system becoming insignificant and life-changing as they knew it. As the final years of Ottoman rule came to an end, and that sealed 400 years of occupation from what was the Ottoman Empire. Palestine suffered many pressing issues, one of which was the presence of European, Jewish, Zionist, settler colonialists, as well as Turkish secularism, which went directly against the nationalism of the native Palestinians. Once the Ottoman Empire chose the side of Germany and Austria-Hungary in the First World War, things began to change rapidly, with soldiers arriving to Palestine to turn their cities into camps for the war effort. The soldiers consumed and utilised everything they could from the Palestinians, from the food to the money that Palestinians possessed, which led to starvation. Palestinians protested, but to no avail, as they were shut down quickly. Then, in the years preceding World War I and even throughout it, Palestine saw cholera epidemics, mass locust attacks consuming crops, bad winters in the mountains, and this was made worse by the war effort between the Ottoman Turks and the Europeans, now at Palestine's doorstep. Palestinians could not withdraw money from banks, prices of basic commodities like flour and sugar increased and were made unaffordable, and food imports had ceased. Palestine as a battleground caused increases in unemployment, collapse of education, scarcity of food, and for death to become a common sight among the Palestinians, which mainly affected children. As the Ottoman soldiers died, they had to be replaced, and this led to the recruitment of young Palestinian Muslims as part of the war, who simply had no choice other than to be soldiers. However, Palestinian Christians and Jews were able to pay a fee to avoid being drafted into the army. Nonetheless, religious leaders from each denomination were chosen to support the Ottoman government in their war effort and to encourage everyone to comply with the state. Forced labour groups were sent to southern Palestine in truly awful conditions, where they paved roads and cut down forests to build railway lines for an Ottoman invasion of Egypt. Ultimately, this did not work out, and in the end, the tracks were used by Britain just a few years later as they entered Palestine. Any known nationalists, part of secret organisations, often in Syria, though they existed across the entire Arab world, promoting their own people's interests rather than Ottoman Turkish interests, were executed for treason. Likewise, anyone disobeying Jamal Pasha's orders or even failing to show their happiness in the large public shows of support that he demanded when he visited Palestine was a risk. If it was not already obvious, Palestinians did not want to be part of this war, as most kept quiet and tried to avoid attention to themselves. All they wanted was to survive it and to survive Jamal Pasha's iron rule over them. The Zionists tried to choose a side to support that would benefit them most in the eventual colonisation of Palestine. As in, by trying to help the winning side, they sought some kind of reward by the end of the war. At first, they tried to help the Ottoman Turks, which Jamal Pasha rejected, and Britain quickly accepted, as they were happy with the additional support and even intelligence. That was of course damaging to the Ottoman Empire. For Zionists, it was beneficial in that it brought the ideology of Zionism closer to a large world power like Britain. Approaching the end of the war, Europeans began to decide on how they will divide and conquer their eventual final land winnings in Western Asia. This included Palestine. This will bring us into the next episode, where we will indeed discuss how exactly the Europeans did this, with what interests were at play, including those of Zionist aspirations to continue their colonisation of Palestine, and discussing the famous Balfour Declaration. Now, there are many dark and unfortunate conclusions from the history you have just heard over the past two episodes. We have explored the lives of Palestinian people throughout the 1800s to early 1900s. And the many factors which affected them both socially and politically, along with their spikes of nationalism and unity against those seeking to subjugate them. But even by the end of the First World War in 1918, despite everything we have discussed, Zionists only made up a small minority of the population of Palestine. They were no more than 5% of the population living in their few and self-isolated communities, and the ideology was by no means a popular movement among European Jews. The Zionists were not ambiguous in their goals of colonising, dispossessing and expelling the native inhabitants of Palestine. They said it in their congressional Zionist meetings, it was in the name of their organisations, and it was all over their documents, diaries, letters and interviews. To conclude, the Palestinians had begun to face the ugly side of Europe that many others had faced before it. Zionism was now established, and there were a number of key principles and factors that can be understood from its slow rise in Europe, which included: number 1, the need to find wealthy financiers for their project. Number 2, establishing common interests and relations with imperial powers. Number 3, utilization of European Judeophobia and Christian millenarianism. Number 4, building biblical pictures to create imagery that European Jews were in some way, somehow, from Palestine themselves, and trying to both indoctrinate and put pressure on European Jews to become Zionist. And number 5, and the single most important factor, was the politics of racial supremacy and European settler colonialism, with the beginnings of what would become a European occupation and colonisation of Palestine by a European people for the sake of European geopolitical interests. Thanks for listening, and please do have a look at episode 3, where we will be discussing the Balfour Declaration and how Europe divided the Middle East between themselves. The resources that we have used for this episode can be found on our website at campaignforpalestine.com, and please also follow us on Instagram at campaignforpalestine. Thanks again. Peace be upon you, and goodbye.